We are talking with Kevin Barrett from Truth Jihad, and we are continuing our discussion about the, well, geopolitical game, pretty much. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about this whole idea of clash of civilizations, the potential scenario for a third world war. This has been discussions that have been going for several years now, pretty much since 9/11. But we have organizations like the Knights of Malta working through mercenary armies like Blackwater. Today, they've called themselves XC instead. And I want to ask you if you think that they actually are involved in a 10th crusade of the Vatican, Kevin. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't really seen evidence showing, you know, that the Vatican is the prime mover behind these geopolitical events. But I know there are people who do believe that. I tend to think that the secret societies may function independently of institutions like the Vatican and the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies, and that these secret societies or criminal organizations, which amount to almost the same thing, since any secret society like Freemasonry, which is primarily about advancing the interests of its members, including material interests and rising through the power and wealth hierarchy, is going to become an organized crime organization fairly quickly. What's the point of being secret if you're not doing something underhanded? So I think these criminal organizations infiltrate kind of official organizations, and I'm sure the Vatican is indeed infiltrated. There's been all sorts of evidence to show that. There was that Vatican banker who was hanged under Blackfriars Bridge in the city of London a couple of decades ago.
Roberto Calvi, yeah.
Right, right. And the money laundering and other kind of organized criminal activity that operates at the Vatican undoubtedly hasn't stopped. In fact, that probably was one of the reasons for the recent Pope's resignation. Mm-hmm. Pope Benedict was apparently very unhappy about a report that he received about people that were described by one author as sexual Freemasons that were being blackmailed due to their kind of extreme homosexual activity in public, and that they were tied into a kind of a money laundering criminal racket. So that's undoubtedly still going on. But I don't think the Vatican per se is necessarily trying to push for a world war. On the other hand, there are little hints that there might be something going on along those lines. There was a professor, I think it was his name, James Wall or something, at the he was in Washington, D.C., and he was quoted as saying that he thought that the invasion of Iraq should have been honestly called what it really was, which is a war against an expanding Islam. Mm-hmm. And so if he's speaking for one contingent within the Vatican, that is people in organized Christianity who are terrified that Christianity is losing adherents and Islam is gaining them, then to some extent, this, you know, those people would be part of the coalition pushing for this clash of civilizations targeting Islam. But I think that actually anti-religious forces in Freemasonry, including those linked to the Rothschilds and the so-called New World Order, which, as I said last time, want to create a new world order that would be new in the sense there wouldn't be any more religion. I think those people are probably more central to the current agenda than the Catholic Church as an organization could be.
What do you think about Freemasonry and the ties to Judaism then? There's been allegedly rabbis speaking out about this. They've looked at the rituals of Freemasonry and recognized the heavy influence of Judaism. And you know, to extend that then into the discussion of this network that we're talking about, the Middle East has always been an important region. So is it Israel? Is it the Jewish population directing to the Vatican to potentially then, if that is true, if they're working through the Knights of Malta and you know, Blackwater, as I said previously, that they're trying to expand into the territory, ultimately, I don't know, helping out Israel? Is there, or is it the reverse? Is it that the Vatican actually just is using Israel to expand into the area? Who's pulling the strings here, do you think?
Well, I don't think the Vatican is expanding at all. I think that Catholicism is actually shrinking as a force in the world. And that is, of course, what the anti-religious Freemasons want. Now, these anti-religious Freemasons, I think, are probably more closely tied to organized Judaism than to any other organized religion. Mm-hmm. Not that they're actual Jews. You know, Jews are people who worship God, the God of the Old Testament. And these people, I think, are really atheists or agnostics who really don't have much use for ordinary religion, and are essentially usurping the place of God, believing that man or Superman, namely themselves, should usurp the place of God. Now, I think that the reason that this current of thought is tied more closely to Judaism than to any other organized religion is twofold. One is that the Jewish communities in Europe, nowhere else, but just in Europe, have traditionally been centers of organized criminal activity. And the reason for that is not that Jewish people are bad or criminal. It's that the Christian community of Europe was extremely bigoted and intolerant. I mean, they wouldn't even let any Muslims live in Europe. If you started trying to build a mosque or be a Muslim in Europe throughout virtually the entire history of Christianity, you'd probably be killed.
Well, that's not true in regions like Cordoba in Spain and all that. That's been a tremendous, nice region where everyone could live, it seems like, for a really long time, right?
Yes, but that was because it was ruled by Muslims. Indeed, anywhere where Muslims ruled, Christians could do very well for the most part, and so could Jews. And most other religions as well. But where Christians ruled in traditional Europe, Muslims were simply not allowed to exist. And Jews were restricted and persecuted. And in response to the persecutions of Jews who were, in fact, allowed to live in Christendom, which Muslims were not, these Jewish communities then developed kind of an adversary relationship with the majority Christian community in which they lived. And this relationship included their being able to economically exploit the larger Christian community through fractional reserve lending, through usury, through lending at interest, which was illegal. In fact, it was considered about the worst crime of all by both Christians and Muslims. And even Jews believed that lending at interest was evil. But then somewhere about 1,000 years ago, some rabbis said, well, I guess it's okay to lend at interest to non-Jews. So Jews began to move into banking, which was then or part of organized crime. And naturally, they also became more fairly overrepresented in other forms of organized crime. And this has continued right down to the present day. Banking became legalized. Usurious banking was legalized 3 or 4 centuries ago in Europe. But by then, these Jewish communities had built up certain families that were the leading banking families. And those families continue to be the leading banking families. And even today, these wealthy Jewish families are extremely overrepresented in world banking and finance. Some people believe that they completely dominate world banking and finance, and I don't have the hard evidence to really prove it either way. But because of this historical situation, when the anti-religious currents began to arise in the 18th century, they became quite powerful. And these anti-religious currents were trying to create this new world order, the first world order without a religious basis. That is, society would be organized in some way other than through a shared devotion to religion. And so they were loosening up the hold of the church and religious ideology on European society. And so naturally, the Jews, who at that time were kind of held back by the majority Christian community. They were allowed to lend at interest, and they'd become big in banking, and they were doing well in certain other ways too. But they were also restricted and to a certain extent despised. They naturally wanted to break out of these ghettos in which they were penned up and be free and equal citizens and be allowed to compete on level ground with the Christians around them. And they knew they would do very well if they were allowed to compete on a level playing field with the Christians. So naturally, the Jewish community was full of people. The smarter people, the more ambitious people, and the wealthier people wanted to break down the restrictions of religion in European society. And so anti-religious Freemasonry, such as the Illuminati of Adam Weishaupt, became very close to powerful, wealthy Jewish families, banking families. And the Rothschilds in particular are said to have financed Weishaupt and the Illuminati and are said to be involved in this sort of current of anti-religious Freemasonry that has been so powerful ever since.
What do you make of something like, well, I have an article here about the 109 locations where Jews have been expelled since about 250 AD, and they listed a bunch of places here, 109 of them from 250 up to, well, 1948 pretty much. Is this a delusion on the part of the, and it's mainly Europe here, as you detailed, is this a delusion from them part? Is this just an completely uncalled for, you know, unreasonable thing that's happening throughout history? Or have, is there anything in the behavior, I guess, that has caused them to be thrown out of so many different areas? What do you think?
Well, of course there's something in the behavior. But I guess, the politically correct line today is to say that the poor persecuted Jews have always been attacked wherever they went, and for no reason whatsoever. And of course, this was the line that was put forth in a kind of exaggerated form in, was it Goldhagen's book, Europe's or Germany's Willing Executioners. But it's also pretty much the standard line that you'll find in Jewish studies departments, Holocaust studies departments, and basically anybody in the academy that deals with these kinds of questions is virtually forced to toe that line. And I do think that Christians, since the Holocaust, have been very much prey to a sort of a guilt trip in which they have been forced to agree with this idea that for all of European history, the Christian majority has woefully mistreated the Jewish minority for no reason at all. And of course, that is an exaggerated view. On the other hand, I do think that the European Christian communities historically were relatively intolerant. And, you know, we can see this by the fact that they may well have not treated Jews very well, but they wouldn't even allow Muslims to exist. There's something in the Christian religion that seems to encourage this kind of fanaticism, this my way or the highway, you know, this idea that the only way to heaven is by atoning for original sin, by accepting Jesus Christ and his horrible death at the hands of his Father as some kind of atonement for human original sin, accepting this sacrificed Jesus as your Lord and Savior. Anybody who does that, no matter how evil they were in their life, goes to heaven. And anyone who doesn't, no matter how saintly they are, goes to hell. I mean, that's been kind of a traditional Christian view. And just to get a sense of how fanatical these, you know, Christians historically have been, and, you know, this is ironic, of course, given that Jesus is the Prince of Peace who said, turn the other cheek. But just, you know, go back and reread Dante's Inferno and look at these hideous punishments that Dante deals out to everybody he doesn't like, and that includes just about everybody that doesn't see things exactly the same way he does. And Christians have been really pretty extreme in this tendency to enforce their orthodoxy on everyone and to persecute and kill people who didn't believe what they believed, certainly compared to Muslims who, as I've said earlier, protected these minority religions everywhere they went. And that's why they're, to this day, in virtually all Muslim lands, there have been minorities of people who are not Christian who live there and are perfectly happy there. As today, there is a significant Jewish minority living in the Islamic Republic of Iran that is very happy in Iran. And no matter how much they are attacked and bribed by the Zionists in Israel, those people refuse to leave Iran. But of course, so getting back to Europe and the Jews, I think that there is some truth to this notion that the Jews did face a lot of persecution from fanatical Christians down through history. They were blamed for killing Jesus, and they were otherwise reviled. And you can see that Jews are just not looked on very well. When you go back and read European history and literature, the majority position is that, you know, Jews are really not very pleasant people. Shakespeare's character Shylock actually is probably a little bit more sympathetic than the average image of Jewish people in historical Christian writings. But at the same time, admitting that Christians have been quite fanatical at times and as a general rule, this notion that the Jewish communities themselves have done absolutely nothing to bring on any of this persecution is absurd. Of course, there are real reasons. As you know, in the Shakespeare play The Merchant of Venice, Shylock is pretty, you know, he's been hurt, his people are persecuted, and he responds by persecuting right back. And naturally, when any two human groups are in conflict, that's always going to happen. One group gets, you know, goes after the other group, and the other group responds in kind. So I think it makes more sense to look at this conflict kind of as a conflict between two groups, not a history of horrible Christian persecution of the Jews. And among the ways that Jews, you know, the kind of behavior of Jewish communities that probably helped contribute to the persecutions of Jews include the organized criminal activity that I mentioned earlier, including lending at interest. Anywhere that anybody lends at interest, assuming that they're able to get repayment, all the money in that society is mathematically guaranteed to exponentially fall into their hands. And not only did Jewish communities tend to monopolize the available money, but they were also apparently quite good at competing for other kinds of desirable positions. And that's why the Christian communities would repeatedly restrict various positions and say, Jews can't do this, Jews can't do that. Because the idea was once you let Jews come in through the door and start practicing a particular profession, for example, what they will do is through nepotism and through fanatical, intense competition and through a certain amount of native talent, they will just completely take over. And that was the attitude of Christendom throughout most of its history. And that accounted for many of the restrictions on Jews today. In the U.S., it's only since about 1950, I believe, that these kinds of restrictions on Jews have been dropped. Prior to then, there were quotas on the number of Jewish students admitted to Ivy League universities. And for that reason, many Ivy League quality Jews came to Madison, Wisconsin, where I live, and made the University of Wisconsin-Madison a sort of Ivy League caliber school, precisely because it was the first choice of Ivy League caliber Jews who were forced by quotas to look up in places other than the Ivy League. But since they've opened up Ivy League schools to Jews, now somewhere between 1/5 and 1/4 of the students at the elite Ivy League universities in the U.S. are Jewish, and Jews are less than 2% of the U.S. population. So they're overrepresented by more than a factor of 10. And studies show that, in fact, they're not that talented. That is, that you can't account for this overrepresentation through test scores, grades, and other kinds of objective criteria. Therefore, it appears that there is a factor of nepotism. That is, Jews, once they get in the door to Ivy League schools, they end up on admissions committees, and they extend favorable admissions treatment to fellow Jews at the expense of non-Jews. And this is precisely what Europeans said Jews were doing in all the professions that they entered throughout the history of Europe. And we can see that there's at least some truth to it, because they're doing it today in Ivy League universities in the U.S.
So is this behavior, if you will, then historically, is it understandable in your view?
Well, it's understandable, but not completely excusable, especially the extremes. The pogroms against Jewish communities, in which whole communities were attacked, people were murdered, tortured, raped. This, of course, is utterly inexcusable. Whether European restrictions on Jews entering professions is excusable is another question. And regardless of how one comes down on that, I do think that you can understand why so many ambitious Jews would favor a kind of New World Order approach to, you know, let's break down the Christian quality of Europe and create secular societies where Jews can compete on a level playing field. And even, you know, from a Jewish perspective, of course, you know, the Jews themselves probably don't even really, they're not conscious of the nepotism that they practice. It's just kind of natural. There's actually a really wonderful Jewish writer, Philip Weiss, who used to work for the New York Times, who wrote an article entitled, Do We Jews Dominate the Media? And if so, or do we Jews dominate the media? And so what if we do? And he pointed out that the majority of people that he had dealt with in major decision-making positions throughout the mainstream media have always been Jewish. He thinks that Jews have more than 50% of all key positions in U.S. media, even though they're less than 2% of the population. And he thinks that there's a kind of unconscious nepotism involved. He says that as a Jew, he feels more comfortable with fellow Jews. So it's just natural that given a choice, he would like to work next to a fellow Jew. So his choice of somebody to hire at the New York Times would be a Jew. If there was an equal choice between a Jew and a Goy, he'd pick the Jew. But it's a natural kind of thing that people do tend to want to associate with people like themselves. And the Jewish community in particular seems a little bit extra insular and a little bit, you know, extra chauvinistic in certain ways, in keeping with their belief that they are the chosen people.
Well, this is, sorry to cut you off, but it seemed to be a double standard on this, because in some regards it's considered to be, if you're pro-homogeneity, if you put it that way, or like, you know, you want to homogenize, or like in Europe, for example, then you're immediately posed as a Nazi, you know. And but in other regards, it's totally acceptable. There seems to be, with the political correctness that has come into the picture, there's no reason behind anything anymore. It's just completely, completely outrageous in that regard. Now, I remember a article, I think it was from the LA Times, by Joel Stein, also arguing the same about Hollywood, practically. There was a poll that many Americans disagreed with the statement that Jews were in control of Hollywood, but he ran down all the reasons why they actually were in control. And then the ADL goes after Joel Stein and says, right, you know, that you're a bigot for saying this. It's hilarious, you know.
Well, it is hilarious because the ADL isn't even trying to show that he's wrong. They just simply assume that he must be wrong, and they don't even really stress that. They're basically trying to train people not to talk about this. And, of course, Hollywood is even more dominated by Jews than the rest of the media. And Stein, of course, is having a lot of fun with that.
Sure.
But you're right about the hypocrisy and the double standard. In Europe, it's true that nationalists who want to preserve the national character of their European countries are branded as bigots and Nazis. And Jews in Israel are, quote-unquote, preserving their national character by committing genocide and behaving in the most outrageous ways, so far beyond anything remotely conceivable in any European country. And yet the dominant discourse says that the Europeans have this problem, you know, with right-wing extremism and so on, and Israel is this poor little innocent country that's, you know, just trying to avoid being pushed into the sea and everything. It's actually pretty bizarre how this discourse has developed. I think it's changing now, though, thanks to the internet and the exposure of the real nature of the state of Israel. There is a very strong backlash that's gathering against Zionism, and I do think that within probably a decade or two, I'm not sure that Israel will be there in the form that it is now.
Let me tie something else into the discussion here. I want to ask you more about, you know, Zionism, political Zionism, and also religious Zionism and everything else. So I don't want to drop that ball. But into all of this as well, then, we have this idea of multiculturalism moving into to Europe. There's something that seems to have changed. If we look at the scenario in Palestine before the creation of Israel, it seems to have been, you know, a peaceful area, pretty much ruled by Muslims, as you say. There was it was an acceptance for both Christians and Jews, I believe, in the area. It was no big problem per se. What is happening today, if I personally speak about an area like in southern Sweden around Malmö, where a lot of Muslims have moved in, there's been a big Jewish population there today. Basically, the Jews are asking for, you know, government money to be protected on the streets, pretty much, because there is such a high violence against the Jews in the area. The local population are pretty much in shambles, trying to flee from the area because there's ongoing riots on a regular basis by the Muslim population there. And so the acceptance level that you speak on one level, I can't see that if I look at a scenario, what's going on in southern Sweden. So I'm wondering, what's going on here? Has something changed? And then to further confuse the issue, if we look at someone like, I don't know if you've heard this clip, it went around the web for a while, but there is an American Jew, Barbara Spector. She did Aliyah, moved to Israel a while back, and then she actually moved to Sweden, working out of Stockholm for the longest time in an organization called Paideia. And in this video clip, she's interviewed by the Israeli Broadcasting Company, and she's saying that, and how she can say this is, of course, beyond any reasonable understanding, but she says that we Jews are working towards making Europe multicultural. That's why we will be resented, pretty much. And so it sounds, first of all, like she's been on a meeting with all the other Jews that where they've, you know, come to this conclusion, which is kind of bizarre. I'm not saying that it hasn't happened, but that she can talk in this way is kind of also, you know, it's humorous to say the least. But so what is happening here to tie all these things together is that if she's in Stockholm working to bring in more cultures into Europe, she is also at the same time then creating a situation like in southern Sweden, where it's so difficult for Jews to be walking around on the streets because they're being harassed by Muslims. So it's and squeezed in between this battle is the Swedish population who's just trying to get out of the area right now. So there is this clash of civilizations happening, you know, right here in my own country. What's this going on, do you think, Kevin?
Well, that's quite bizarre. I don't know anything about it, so I can't really comment from an informed perspective. I can imagine, though, that the problem stems not from any kind of innate, you know, Muslim intolerance of Jews, because there isn't one. At least, you know, if you compare the way Jewish communities were treated in Islamic lands versus Christian lands throughout the past 1,500 years, Jews were treated quite well, relatively, for the most part, in Islamic lands. And, of course, they were they didn't do as well in the Christian lands. Well, they did well, but they had a much more adversarial relationship with Christians, and there were a lot of incidents of very extreme persecution. So it's not that Muslims have that big of a problem with Jews. I think it's a case of Muslims being absolutely, just amazed and astounded and chagrined at the Zionist genocide in Palestine. And a lot of Muslims, at least those politically active ones, are outraged and furious at this genocide. And so what I would just imagine is probably happening in Sweden if Muslims are attacking Jews on the street is a lot like what would happen in Skokie, Illinois, outside of Chicago, when the Nazi party would go march in Skokie. This was, I don't know how many times they did this, but there used to be an American Nazi party in maybe the 1970s, and they would come to Skokie, Illinois, which is a Jewish suburb of Chicago, heavily Jewish suburb. Of course, we don't have official apartheid Jews-only areas here like they have in occupied Palestine, but Skokie has a lot of Jewish residents. And so every year for a while, the Nazis would come and have their big annual rally in Skokie, Illinois, and they would parade up and down the streets of Skokie in their stormtrooper boots and their swastikas, waving Nazi flags, you know, and shouting Sieg Heil and things like that. And the Jews of Skokie and angry anti-Nazis from other places, including Madison, Wisconsin, would go down to Skokie and attack these Nazis. They would throw rotten fruit at them. You know, they would try to physically attack them. And the police always had a hard time keeping the Nazis and the anti-Nazis separated. And so, you know, you can understand why American Jews would be angry at Nazis who were just, you know, running around in public admitting that they're Nazis. Well,
sure.
When Jews who are running around in public admitting that they're Zionists are viewed in exactly the same way by Muslims, at least Muslims who are awake and notice the genocide in Palestine, you know. Now, if Jews are anti-Zionist, that's different. A Jew who says, you know, this is a horrible genocide and I absolutely don't support it, or even I'm not even interested. I have nothing to do with that. I don't care about what's happening over in Palestine. That such a Jewish person obviously is completely innocent of any kind of complicity and should certainly not be viewed as a criminal by anyone. But the fact is that most powerful, organized people in Jewish communities in Europe as well as in the U.S. are supporters of the genocide in occupied Palestine. And so they are naturally going to get the same reaction from Muslims as a Nazi who was in favor of a genocide against Jews would get from Jews. You know, they need to understand that.
And I wanted to say as well, there definitely could be an exaggeration here in terms of the level of the attacks on Jewish people in southern Sweden. I don't know the exact numbers or anything like that, but this is what I've heard from media, and one of the program that I was talking about earlier, from the Israeli Broadcasting Company, brought this up as well. But nonetheless, there is also one thing I do know is that there is regular riots in southern Sweden. And whenever the Swedish Democratic Party is down there having a completely legal demonstration in the area, it quickly turns ugly, and these, you know, violent so-called anti-fascists are out and completely wrecking it all the time. So it's a battle going on. It seems like there is this clash of civilization, and I'm just wondering what you make of all of this, Kevin, and where you think when it comes to homogeneity and choosing where you want to live or with the people you want to live with, Is that something wrong? Should people not be able to do that? Should anybody could live anywhere where they want to on the planet? I mean, should we have any such rules as human beings? What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. And I do now lean towards thinking that people should have the right to choose where they want to live and, or whether with around whom they want to live. This idea of absolute total integration and complete multiculturalism, I think, is probably a kind of a utopian idea that isn't likely to be realized anytime soon, except maybe in a very few areas. I recently had a white identity author on my radio show who takes a line that is really reviled here in the U.S. by saying that it's okay for white Americans to be proud of being white. It's okay for them to want to exclude non-white people from the U.S. by immigration restrictions. It's okay for them to want to go to schools with other white people rather than with non-whites, mm-hmm. to live in neighborhoods with other white people rather than with non-whites. This is all very controversial. In fact, it's a very, very minority position here in the U.S. You're really not allowed to talk like that in public.
Sure.
And so this guy naturally gets a lot of flack. But I think that some of his arguments are pretty good. And we hear the same arguments from certain African Americans as well. Actually, the best ones, people like Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam, who is the most eloquent and truthful spokesperson for African Americans today. And the Honorable Minister Farrakhan, who gave a terrific speech at the Savior's Day convention a month and a half, 2 months ago, which I was lucky enough to attend, and I had a backstage pass. I got to watch it from just a few feet behind the minister. And I got to listen to his arguments, and he's long said that, let's face it, people do like to live with people who are like them, that African Americans are really not going to be doing well when they're forced into integration with the white majority. And so they really need to be able to separate and have their own institutions. And he's even arguing now for their own farmlands. He wants to take up a collection among African Americans, buy a lot of farmland, and go and start growing nutritious food. Because today there's a kind of a slow motion genocide. African Americans are getting junk food, and they're food deserts in the big cities where you can't buy nutritious food within miles. And so he's advocating an effort to have African Americans work together and be in their own communities, growing good food and empowering themselves through this kind of separatism and nationalism, which is a lot like the white nationalism that I was talking about. And a lot of these ideas, I think, are reasonable if you don't push them too far and if you don't get violent about them. That is, it's reasonable to say that it's just a natural thing that people are going to be living among their own ethnicities, among the people who speak their languages and have their religions. And we should kind of get used to the fact that that's a normal human desire, and we should allow for that desire to be fulfilled. And I think this sort of politically correct attack on any form of segregation or separatism or ethnic pride, any kind except for Jewish ethnic pride, that's legal, but everything else is completely taboo. Even Minister Farrakhan is attacked as a racist.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think that this is a kind of a symptom of a sort of anti-human nature and anti-nature strand of Christian and post-Christian thought. That is, that the Christian religion has had this tendency, not all Christians are the same in this, but there's been this tendency to say that we live in a fallen world, that, God created this world really screwed up, or something mm-hmm. happened to it. The devil came down to earth, John Milton's poem, the fall happened, and then there was the fall of man. And so both nature itself and human nature are fatally flawed, and they could only be redeemed by the horrible death of God's Son on the cross. This is if you step outside of this for a moment and look at how does this look from the viewpoint of some other culture, it looks completely insane. And then, you start to wonder if, maybe some of this extreme Christian behavior over the years, and there's been extreme good Christian behavior as well as bad, but the fact is that there is, culture of Christianity has developed this materialist post-Christian culture that's paving the earth. there's an extreme germ phobia, people with antibiotic soap everywhere, lawns of exactly the same kind of grass, stretching for miles and miles around identical cookie cutter houses. And if you try to grow a vegetable garden in your front yard, you'll be run out of town or thrown in jail. You know, there's this kind of hatred of nature. And in the old days, of course, it was part of a hatred of human sexuality as well. Christians were notorious for hating sexuality and hating nature and being at war with nature. Nathaniel Hawthorne explored this in his wonderful writings, Young Goodman Brown and other stories. And of course, that's the puritanical extreme, but that's just an extreme version of something that's found in Christianity. So I do think that Christian culture has just never really been at ease with the nature of things. It wants to redo everything. It wants a new heaven and a new earth. It can't live with nature the way it is and human nature the way it is. It's always trying to reform everything. Islam is very different. Islam, we believe that everybody is born perfect. Everything is perfect. A perfect God can only make a perfect creation. And our only problem is forgetting our real perfection. And we need a little reminder, and that's where scripture comes in. So from that viewpoint, a Muslim culture by itself would never pave the earth. It would tend to live much more in harmony with the earth. It would probably never develop the antibiotics and the other, the techniques that would allow for population explosion in the first place, because people just wouldn't work that hard, because they wouldn't be driven by this hatred of themselves, their sexuality, and of nature. They would relax and they would, stop and pray for 20 minutes five times a day. They wouldn't get nearly as much done, but they would be so much happier, more peaceful. They would create a society that would be so much more advantageous for the spiritual flowering of the human soul, which is what this existence is all about. And so I think post-Christian culture has taken a wrong turn. I think that post-Christian culture is on the road to hell, literally and figuratively. It's trying to flee from human nature. It's telling us we have to have gay marriage, which is something no human culture has ever had in history. There's no such thing. It's completely against human nature. And yet they're trying to force it on everybody and tell us that we are evil bigots and human rights abusers if we refuse to conform to this lunatic new science fiction, brave new world that they're trying to inflict on us. And likewise, this integration ideal, everybody has to integrate with all the other kinds of people, is another of these kinds of post-Christian utopias where they're just trying to destroy the natural way of things and inflict some imaginary, rational ideal on everyone. And, liberalism in the American sense, and progressivism and leftism in the European sense has been afflicted with this tendency to redo everything, destroy nature, try to build a rationalistic utopia in place of what used to be human. And I think that this whole tendency is now kind of on the verge of destroying the planet and destroying humanity. And we may end up with a world of a post-human world in which some kind of machine will have gobbled up all of the energy sources and killed off humans, probably killed off all forms of life. It'll be a gray goo that they invented in a lab, or a robot that runs by, eating any kind of life. It can get its power by eating trees, vegetation, humans.
Or human flesh. They've human been, flesh, been developed already, allegedly, by the Pentagon, I think.
Of course.
DARPA.
Yeah, that's just the extreme example of this tendency I'm talking about. So for these reasons, I've always agreed with the traditionalists, who are actually the most influential school in religious studies, who believed that Islam was what would save Europe. That is, that Europeans, they wouldn't be able to believe in Christianity anymore. It's too goofy, and they would be lost, and they would be flailing around with these heresies like Marxism and stuff. And then finally, they would realize, wait a minute, here's this religious tradition that's very, very close to Christianity, but without the various insane aspects that Christianity has. And so that Europe would become Muslim and would be able to reclaim the good parts of its Christian heritage and throw off the bad parts. And I'm still hoping that that may happen, inshallah.
When did you convert to Islam, by the way, if you don't mind asking?
1993.
Much of Europe has, although we still have the churches and they ring every hour and the bells show at noon, etc., much of Europe have moved away from Christianity, at least in Northern Europe and Scandinavia particularly. It's been a long time away from that right now. I think that they would do better actually returning to their native cultures and religions, which was once there before the before Christianity moved in and basically, you know, killed off all the people that were into the more so-called pagan religions. But nonetheless, there is another side to all of this as well, which is, for example, you know, freedom of speech and things like that. Do you recall the controversy? I think it was started back in 2005. A Danish newspaper published these 12 cartoons of Muhammad. Do you recall that situation?
Oh, of course. Yeah, that was international news.
Yeah, and then consequently, there was another Swedish one who did it as well, Larsviks, and he has also been persecuted and everything as well. And he, you know, allegedly did these things as a expression of freedom to be able to also have a humorous angle to all this. Do you think it's right that these people are being persecuted as well and have to have guards around them in certain cases because their lives are being threatened because they can't express themselves anymore in a newspaper? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a very unfortunate situation. On the one hand, I do think that the Muslim view of what blasphemy is should be, you know, how we should view issues like blasphemy and limits to free speech, actually, it makes more sense to me. Maybe it's because I'm Muslim, but I think even before I was Muslim, in some ways, it would have made more sense than either a kind of an absolute free speech, anybody can say anything, anytime kind of notion, which ignores things like so-called fighting words, is what we call them here in the U.S. I'm from Wisconsin, where we cheer for the Green Bay Packers football team. If I go to Chicago, where they cheer for the Chicago Bears football team, and I walk into a bar during a Bears game in my Green Bay Packers t-shirt and start saying obscene things about the Chicago Bears, there will be violence. And the same is true, I'm sure, with footballers in Europe as well.
Sure.
So let's, you know, accept that there is this kind of limit of appropriate expression, that when people use words that are intended to cause or just obviously will cause violence, that those people bear some of the responsibility for any violence that ensues, and they probably should have thought more carefully before they used those words. And so that's a basic, you know, kind of principle to apply in all of these situations. And then the question of, well, what kind of fighting words in general? Are there classifications of certain kinds of these words that need to be, you know, regulated, or that we should just accept, you know, shouldn't be used? And traditionally, in European society and in Islamic society, really all human societies have this notion of the sacred and profane. Virtually all of them have notions of blasphemy. That is, there's certain kinds of things that you can't say because they violate the notion of the sacred. And that's how it's always been, and it's a part of human nature. Every human society is always going to be more or less like that, except for maybe a few, you know, freaks that develop briefly and then disappear, because this is rooted in human nature. So then the question is, well, what is blasphemous? What kinds of blasphemy should we be regulating? The Muslim position is that those of us who are living in this, you know, culture that's based on monotheism, which is this Christian, you know, Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, we have a tradition that says that attacking religion and religious symbols, at least when you cross the line in the way you do it, is considered taboo. You're not supposed to do that. If you do that, you'll be punished one way or another. And that's, I think, a kind of a normal situation. Today, we're living in a very strange world in which people will be punished if they ask questions about various historical aspects of the Nazi Holocaust. Yeah. If you point out that there are good questions about the extent or even existence of human gas chambers, for example, which I believe after having finally studied this, I wouldn't have said this a year and a half ago, but today after having finally done some reading about it, I think that there are some good questions about that. And yet if you simply ask these perfectly valid, legitimate questions, in many European countries, you will be thrown in jail.
Well, I remember Richard Williamson, who was actually in Germany, I think, did an interview with a Swedish television. He was asking these questions, and he was, extradited, I think, right? After, you know, consequently, he belonged to the SSPX, I think. Pious, I forget the name of it. But do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. I actually was trying to get him on my radio show, but didn't succeed.
Yep.
Uh, But yeah, that's just one example. So here we have a Christian bishop who asks questions about European history and is punished for talking about that. So that's blasphemy. Effectively, in Europe today, the Holocaust is the only sacred religion. And it's anybody who says the wrong things, including simply asking questions about history, is treated as a heretic and punished for their blasphemy.
Isn't that the most dangerous thing that we can do? In any regard, whatever goes on in society and everything, not to be able to talk about these things, not to be able to question, not to be able to discuss, and putting the lid on it because it's too, you know, painful or whatever. Isn't that the worst thing that we can actually do?
Absolutely. I do. I think so. I think that asking questions about history should be acceptable. And for instance, if someone is asking questions about Islamic history, and these questions are uncomfortable for most Muslims, I still think that certainly in modern countries that are not Muslim majority countries, such people absolutely should not be punished. Now, there are some, like there's an Islamic studies person named Patricia Crone, who has, I think, probably made some bad judgments about historical fact and done it in a way that is offensive to Muslims. But even so, I would defend her right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a question of where you draw the line. But overall, it seems to me that the world Muslim community is drawing the line in a much more sensible place than the world Christian community. The world Muslim community says, don't attack religious symbols. We don't attack Jesus. You know, if we wouldn't even imagine like publishing cartoons with, you know, Jesus in, you know, degrading positions or anything like that. It's unthinkable because we Muslims do not attack other people's sacred symbols. Well, the Taliban went and blew up the Buddhas, but the Taliban are the Taliban. You know, they're they're a little excitable and tribal and not representative of the majority of Muslims. Whereas the Christian world says, well, you can attack religious symbols all you want, the more the better, but don't even ask any questions about history, especially really good questions about a particular episode of history that has, you know, triggered this genocide in Palestine. You know, if you ask any questions about the legitimating myth of this genocide in Palestine, you're going to go to jail. And that's crazy. So I think the Muslim view of this overall is much more sensible than the European view. But at the same time, I think many of the world's Muslims are reacting in a very mindless way to these provocations, going and chasing down and trying to lynch people for these cartoons. I think it's really counterproductive and really stupid. And it's unfortunate that many, many Muslims around the world are, you know, our biggest problem is this kind of refusal to be sophisticated. And, you know, this kind of, you know, knee-jerk reaction to things, this inability to think things through, this inability to be sophisticated, reasonable, and strategic in the way we behave. These are some of the shortcomings that are afflicting a lot of Muslims around the world, which is one reason that so many Muslims have gotten sucked into actually doing the work of their enemies. Like in Syria today, there are a whole lot of supposedly Muslim mercenaries who are destroying Syria on behalf of the Zionists. Why are they doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're, for the most part, incredibly stupid. I mean, they're just not sophisticated. There's this kind of obscurantism that is very deeply rooted in significant portions of the Muslim population today. Saudi Arabia has got more than its share. Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan have a fair bit. And you can find it, you know, cropping up, I'm sure, in Sweden, too. Probably some of these Swedish Muslims who are running around rioting are being affected by this kind of obscurantist tendency to act in this knee-jerk kind of way. So, yeah, I think it's just unfortunate that we're in a situation where even though the Muslim perspective is correct, which is that the limits to free speech should end at blasphemy, and blasphemy should be about religion, not about history. History should be wide open for any kind of critical discussion.
But where do they separate? They're joined at some point.
Yeah, there's certainly an overlap between religion and history. But when you're addressing something from a purely historical perspective and saying, well, I'm just using historical methods to figure out what happened at this episode in history, and that's really what you're doing, then you're engaging in history, and there shouldn't be any limits on how you do that. Whereas when you're dealing in symbols that a community agrees are sacred symbols, or a significant, you know, element of the community takes as sacred symbols, for the most part, those sacred symbols should be respected. And history is not really about sacred symbols. History has a series of methods for trying to arrive at empirical truth about the past. Sacred symbols have nothing to do with that. Religion has a very different approach to the past. When you're engaging in study of the Hadith and Islam, you're not doing history per se. And you're involved in a field that has this notion of the sacred. So when you're dealing with sacred symbols of religions, whatever religions they are, you should respect those. And blasphemy against them should be understood that people will be punished for their blasphemy. So I make that distinction. That is a traditional distinction. It takes into consideration the development of secular historiography, but it also respects the existence of religion and the sacred.
I mean, what you mentioned earlier about the football team is a good analogy. I think, well, at least to me, then, from my perspective, it's I still consider it to be like a football game, and or you choose a team in a sense. And with this comes with this religious tie comes a kind of a fanaticism as well. I'm not an atheist. I'm a spiritual person, but I'm not really tied down to any one of these Abrahamic religions or, you know, Buddhism or anything like that. But what I don't understand is where in the religion when it comes something comes in which seems to dominate people's entire lives, entire mind and outset and view of life and everything to such a degree that many are ready to, as you say, fight for it, and even in some cases lay down their own lives to protect it, you know, because it's something that they've identified with, and they want to protect it like that they're protecting themselves almost. So if there is a questionable spot or a weak spot or something like that, people become defensive as soon as you begin to question it. So that's one thing I'm struggling with and try to understand what this, well, to me, I can't see it as anything else as a form of a mind control, a religion being one of the first really effective ways of mind controlling people into having belief about something and faith, which made them, you know, in they step into another kind of reality almost. They become, with this fanaticism comes a kind of an idea that they're supernatural almost, that they have God at their side and therefore they're righteous and they can do anything they want. And so nothing they can do is bad or wrong. And so without using, you know, our reasonable capacities as human beings, they're bypassed with religion. And that's the most dangerous thing with it, as I see it anyway. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I guess I wouldn't fully agree with that, because I think that the perspective that you just expressed is the product of the modern sort of replacement of religion with reason. And so I think that also has its dangers, that reason is sometimes turned into a false god that is even more destructive than God ever could be. Historically, if you look back at Islamic Spain, and there are some great books about this, in particular, there's one by Maria Menocal, that is Menocal. I'm not remembering the title right at the moment, but one of her books is Shards of Love, but that's not the one. anyway, she goes back and looks at Islamic Spain and argues that actually there was more tolerance in Islamic Spain than there has been in the modern world. And this is that, you know, people were allowed to be different in Islamic Spain. There was a Christian community, there was a Muslim community, there was a Jewish community, and there was really no effort to try to put everybody in the same cookie cutter and force everyone to think alike, act alike, and obey kind of the same set of laws. And the way law worked was even very different. Today, we think that laws should always be enforced. Everybody has to obey the law, and everybody has to have the same set of laws. But law was something that you would kind of, you know, you would be respecting a religious law in your own life the way that you wanted to, the way you felt was right between you and God, and you and your religious instructors, whether it's your parents or the local religious scholar. And if you have a question or a dispute, you can take it to the religious scholar. But if you don't like what they say, you can go to another religious scholar. The whole thing is very organic, and there's really not very much enforcement. Virtually no real law enforcement. It's all informal. And it was working well. And so it really allowed for a lot of freedom and a lot of real deep pluralism. Today, and since the Enlightenment, and actually Menocal says since the Renaissance, which was the beginning of all this, we've been living in this kind of cookie-cutter world where reason tells us everybody has to be alike, everybody has to follow the same laws, all laws should be completely enforced, you know, everybody violates a law needs to have exactly the same punishment, and it has to be consistent. Of course, if that were the case, the entire population of the Western world would be in prison permanently, because we've all, you know, accidentally or on purpose violated enough laws, including some trivial laws we'd never heard of, that if all laws were consistently enforced the way we think they're supposed to be, we'd all be on the inside of jail all the time. Maybe we all are. Maybe our minds are on the inside of jail all the time because of this. So I don't really buy this notion that reason is this idol that we all have to bow down to.
I want to preface that by saying I'm not talking about the science delusion or the methods propagated by the people who advocate reason as such. I'm just saying we have different capabilities, strengths, if you will, as human beings, where we can look at things on multiple different perspectives. And I'm just saying that if you allow yourself to just bypass that capability that we have to sit down and rationally try to think something over, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice, and we just act on emotions because they're tied to our, you know, religious center of the brain or something like that. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I'm sure there's some truth to that. But again, if you really, you know, it sounds nice, and that's the dominant, you know, that's the dominant paradigm that we're living in since the Enlightenment. And yeah, I think there were some gains with the Enlightenment. But if you go back and look at the great thinkers in history, well, they're all different, of course. But, you know, you're making it sound as if a religious person is going to be just cutting off their reflection at a certain point and just going with a certain emotional logic that's going to lead them to behave in a very violent, tribalistic way. If you go back and read, let's say, Thomas Aquinas or maybe Ibn Arabi or al-Ghazali in Islamic history, or even Maimonides in Jewish history, or Buddhist scholars, Hindu scholars, you know, if you could go back and talk to a Native American religious leader or a shaman from Siberia, you know, in other words, talking to these religious people, you might be surprised to discover that their minds may be a lot freer and a lot deeper, that their level of reflection might actually be way beyond what almost anybody is doing today. And, you know, you say, well, why is that? I think the answer is that this revolution of reason and science has done great violence to the human spirit, and that we have this tendency, well, in biological terms, it's the left brain dominance, you know.
Sure.
I think Dr. Schlein was right when he said that in his book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, that hyperliteracy kind of puts people's left brains on steroids.
Absolutely.
And so they become very linear, very dogmatic, kind of masculine in their thought styles. That's why women are running around in shoulder pads wanting to join the workforce rather than being with kids and other women, as women have always been throughout history. Because today, a lot of women aren't really you know, they're not women anymore.
That's due to science as well. That's due to all the chemicals that's been inserted into our, you know, civilization. And today, these are actually endocrine disruptors that are completely changing, you know, how the brain functions. And we're basically reversing what's, you know, what's male and female in these days. And there's like so many studies have been done on it, yet we continue to do it. So there's a lot of reasons for this, but go ahead, Kevin.
Well, yeah, no, you're right. I think in some ways that's been even tougher on men. That is, men are even less men now than women are women.
Yeah. It's true.
And again, this is part of Western post-Christian culture's war on human nature. Human nature is that we have two biological sexes, and they're very, very different in their minds and their souls and their bodies and their behavior, their way of seeing the world. And this difference is good. And that's what Islamic Spain understood. The difference is fine. Let somebody else be Jewish and have a totally different set of laws from the ones I respect. Otherness is okay. And that's, I think, the reason tends to try to obliterate otherness. It can't deal with otherness. And for me, monotheism, in a sense, is all about absolute loving surrender to the ultimate other. And God is the ultimate other. But that posture of absolute loving surrender is something that we should kind of emulate in our dealings with all forms of the other. It's hard, you know, because certain kinds of others rub us the wrong way, and we, you know, they can even behave badly and we can get angry at them. But, you know, this ends up being not that different from what Jesus taught, you know, love your enemy, turn the other cheek. I think that there's a deep wisdom in that from an Islamic perspective as well as a Christian perspective, because, again, this otherness is what we need to be taught to surrender to and love. We have to get out of our egos. You know, the Sufis talk about the annihilation of the ego, because we just get, you know, caught in this, you know, our whole mental lives and consciousness get structured around the self. Everything is either self or not self. It's either for the self or against the self. The self, it becomes self-centered, literally. The whole structure, everything, all perceptions are viewed in terms of their relationship to this self, which, and that self is actually an illusory construct that's stopping us from experiencing deeper feelings of love and oneness with the universe, and even from noticing the, you know, zillions of things that are going on all around us at every moment. And mysticism is all about that. Mysticism is about the annihilation of the ego and allowing us to see what's really there, both the world around us and ultimately God. So I think religion gets at this better than reason does.
Yeah, let's do a what-if scenario. Let's say we have a majority of Muslims in Europe in the future, who knows, 50, 100 years ago, in the future, I mean. I've seen demonstrations in Holland and things like that for Sharia law for Europe, pretty much. If that's the case, at that point, will there be dress codes for, let's say, European women wearing, you know, burqa or niqab? How could this develop? That's my question.
Well, I haven't seen demonstrations of Muslims in Europe calling for all of Europe to immediately start following Sharia. And any Muslims who are actually calling for that would have to be pretty ignorant, because Sharia law is basically applied to Muslims, and other religions are supposed to be protected by Islam, and they're supposed to have their own laws. That's why Christian communities in Islamic lands have always been allowed to drink alcohol, even though we Muslims believe alcohol is the worst drug out there. It's worse than heroin, worse than methamphetamine, you know, worse than PCP. Alcohol is the worst drug. It's the one that's mentioned in the Quran. And empirically, it probably does the most damage of any drug in the world, except maybe tobacco. So Muslims are very, very dead set against alcohol. If you drink a glass of wine in the presence of a Muslim, it's absolutely the equivalent of, you know, shooting up heroin in front of a kind of bourgeois European Christian. So you just have, I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but just admit that's what you're doing. You know, you're showing a certain kind of disrespect. Just like if I went to the house of a bourgeois, you know, elderly woman in Paris or something, and I, you know, sat down at the dinner table, and as we were about to start eating dinner, I pulled out my needle and cooked up some heroin and stuck it into my vein and right under her nose, it would be a sign of disrespect to her. Many people, you know, Europeans who drink alcohol don't understand what a tremendous sign of disrespect this is to do that in front of a Muslim. So Muslims have that strong feeling against alcohol, but even so, throughout all of history, Christians living in Muslim lands have been making and enjoying and being damaged by alcohol, because that's just, Muslims don't inflict their own laws on everybody else. That's what deep pluralism is about. So any Muslims who are running around Europe, like saying all you Europeans have to immediately submit to Sharia and start dressing exactly the same as Muslims and following all of the Muslim rules, including stop drinking alcohol and so on, that's pretty crazy. And it's really not anything related to Islamic tradition.
Say it's not representative of the majority? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so. I mean, far from it. In fact, the vast majority of Muslims, the problem with them is not that they're too fanatical. The problem with them is that they're not nearly fanatical enough. I mean, you know, there's a much bigger problem with Muslims actually drinking alcohol than there is with Muslims trying to inflict their dislike of alcohol on non-Muslims. You know, there's a much bigger problem with Muslims not praying five times a day and therefore losing the benefits of prayer and losing the spiritual cohesion in the Muslim society than there is of Muslims running around trying to tell anybody else to pray five times a day. You know, there may be a handful of idiot Muslims out there running around telling European non-Muslims that they should be doing, you know, acting like pious Muslims, but I can't believe there are really very many. There are hundreds of times more Muslims, you know, acting badly. They're the ones really that Muslims should be trying to educate. As far as Europe becoming Muslim, the scenario that I would envision obviously would not be a bunch of lunatic lower class Muslims running around parading in the streets with signs and somehow inflicting Sharia on the majority of non-Muslim Europeans. That ain't going to happen. The scenario that I would see would be more a kind of a reaction against the current European culture, which is very hedonistic, overly rationalistic, out of touch with the sacred. It's, you know, reached the point where people are so self-centered that they're not having very many children. And this loss of the sacred, loss of the family values, this kind of, you know, extreme hedonism in parts of European culture and selfishness, living for the self, and materialism, being only interested in the material world and completely oblivious to the spiritual world. All of these things, I think, are going to run their course. And at some point, a generation is going to rebel against that. And the generation is going to say, wow, you know, our parents were, you know, who really screwed up this world that we've been born into that they thought was so great. It was an artificial paradise, like Baudelaire said, or mm-hmm. A Brave New World, like Aldous Huxley said. And we want to return to the sacred. We want to live for something that's beyond these material pursuits and beyond selfish pursuit of material pleasure. And Christianity is no longer working here. So what I would see is that a whole bunch of young Europeans might turn to Islam in the same way that the traditionalists did a century ago. And then it's not going to happen overnight. What would happen is that you would get a significant European Muslim group that would be growing, that would tend to be very moderate and liberal in general and very European in its culture. And this group would be the nucleus that would slowly grow. It would actually encourage Europeans to return to Christianity as well. We Muslims would love you Christians to be good Christians. You know, we don't necessarily want to convert you. If you could be a really good Christian, in some ways that would be even better than being a good Muslim. I mean, you'd have to be a turn the other cheek, love your neighbor. You'd have to follow those teachings of Sayyidina Isa, Jesus, whose teachings are even, you know, stronger in some ways than the teachings that Muslims follow. That would be great. So I would see this generation of, you'd get a bunch of European Muslims joining with the foreign Muslims and maybe kind of educating them and actually sort of helping them get integrated in European culture. And as that group grows, as its pro-religion, it actually helps bring more Europeans into religion in general, including Christianity. And Europe returns to becoming a religious society with a very strong group of Muslims. Maybe it becomes a majority Muslim, maybe not. But that's how I would see it. I certainly mm-hmm. wouldn't see it as some kind of invasion of like working class. The problem in Europe is really more of a class sociological thing than a religious conflict, I think, right now. You know, it's these poor people and working people who immigrated and can't fit in. There aren't jobs for them. They become sort of an underclass. And if they were Buddhist, it would be exactly the same situation.
Do you think it's I have a couple of more questions for here? It's a very interesting discussion. Hearing about this, do you think it's ironic or sad, of course, as well, but that the majority of Muslim immigration, you know, those who immigrate to Europe, Muslims, is due to the wars as well that has been inflicted by, you know, the US, the UK, Australia, Poland, even Sweden is in there, have troops in the, you know, many other European countries as well. We've gone into Afghanistan, Iraq. I think there's been in Somalia activity as well, and now Libya, I would guess, as well. So it seems like someone is basically just stirring around the pot to me, just creating havoc, if you will, with these wars. You shatter, you know, populations into different areas, and I guess the bigger question weaved into all this, Kevin, is there a conspiracy to break up nations and break up people in this way that's happening right now, pretty much?
Yeah, I think that's what this so-called New World Order wants to do. You know, we've talked about this before. I think, you know, David Rockefeller came right out and admitted it. He said, you know, he thanked the media for keeping this secret. He said, we never could have accomplished this without you. We never could have reached this point of building a power structure of the world's biggest bankers and financiers hiring the world's top technocrats to run this new world order if you guys in the media had blown the whistle on us. So thank you for keeping quiet. So there's no question that they're doing that. And in order to create a one world government financed by the banksters and administered by their hired gun technocrats, these people are smashing the world into pieces, starting with the Muslim world so that there won't be any threat to Israel. And then, you know, they're very happy to see all of these refugees streaming into Europe, causing this multicultural kind of dissolution of traditional European culture. I think they're very happy with mass migrations, very happy that the U.S. is turning Mexican. They want to keep those borders open. They don't want any cohesive societies out there, because cohesive middle-class educated societies would be a competing power structure. And they want only one power structure, and that's them.
So yeah, exactly. This is one point I want to make earlier. This is about creating conflict on the ground level, it seems like, if you will, to instead of everyone getting together, looking at the top, at the elite, what they're doing, ruling from the top down, people are busy, you know, being irritated or you know, something mundane like that on their neighbor. Do you see what I mean?
It's like, absolutely. Yeah, they've got the Syrian Alawis, you know, fighting the Kurds, fighting the Sunnis, fighting the Wahhabis in Syria. They've got the Shia South fighting the Sunni center, fighting the Kurdish North over in Iraq.
Yeah.
They've got the Salafi East fighting the Gaddafi West in Libya. They've broken Sudan up into two pieces, with South Sudan now being an Israeli-occupied zone. They're smashing the world, and especially the Muslim world, up into little pieces as part of this divide-and-conquer strategy. And they're also encouraging ethnic conflict, class conflict, and religious conflict. Ethnic conflict in societies like the U.S. and Europe, in order to fragment those societies so that they will not be a competing power center as this new world order tries to tighten its grip on the world.
If Islam is an update, if you agree with that, on previous religions, pretty much we have this relationship, obviously, between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They all come out of Abraham, who became the first Jew, practically, when he entered into that covenant with God due to his willingness to sacrifice his firstborn son, Isaac. And if this is the story, as I've understood it correct, and this is the fundament, if you will, the basis that all of these religions are created upon, is there, I'm using that word again, reason, but is there reason to think that out of something, this to me, it's almost like evolution, right? The theory of evolution being a flawed one, saying that out of something lesser comes something greater. Out of something that is less complex comes something more complex, which has always been a very interesting dilemma to me. And at the same time, I can see this same idea in these religions. If we have Judaism first, we have do you see that there is a refinement of it then? So it eventually evolves like evolution into to Islam? Or how do you see that?
Yeah, actually, I kind of, it's a simplistic way of looking at it, but you could always say that Islam is monotheism 1.3.
Right, yeah.
I think there's a kind of a dialectic at work. Judaism represents a tribal group that is just beginning to recognize that its tribal idol is really not God, that God is this universal thing that's, not so anthropomorphic. And then Christianity comes along and takes it one step in the direction of even more universality, and takes a very, very strong ethical and moral step forward towards loving the other. And then Islam comes along because the Christian solution, while correct, is so radical that most people can't actually abide it. That is, most people really can't spend their whole lives loving their neighbor and turning the other cheek. And this idea of completely overturning human nature and turning people into, love bunnies who are hopping around loving everybody at every moment is wonderful for those who can do it. And there are a few saints who achieve that. But as an organizing principle for humans on earth, it's ahead of its time. So Islam comes along with a kind of a synthesis to this thesis and antithesis of Judaism and Christianity. And the synthesis involves both aspects of kind of justice and absolute justice and a non-anthropomorphic notion of God, which comes out of Judaism, and also a kind of love of the other, love, mercy, compassion as the first characteristic of God, which you don't find in Judaism, but it, of course you do in Christianity. So Islam takes, I think, these the true parts of Judaism and Christianity and kind of puts them in final form for people to use. So it's, to me, I think Islam, you know, really has a good case in when it says that it's the final Middle Eastern monotheistic revelation, that this user's manual is now in its final form. I don't think you have to be a fanatical fundamentalist to say that there's reason to accept that. Now, to get this, you have to actually, you know, you have to ask the right questions about religion. You can't just be running around saying, well, how could this be true if there's some crazy Muslim doing some stupid thing over in this particular place at this particular time?
Of course not. I mean, we have people all over from the world, you know, who actually have allegiances to other organizations, but claiming that they're representative of a religion or a people or whatever. I mean, it can never be on the basis of one person's behavior, right? Yeah.
I mean, if you want to cherry pick for bad behavior, you can make any group look bad.
That's right.
And of course, that's what people do to the groups that they don't like.
Yeah.
But I think that if you look at really what's the core characteristics of Islam, you ask the question about what are the essentials of Islam? And those essentials are really pretty convincing in terms of an absolute monotheism. So we're not, you know, running around worshiping anything else or anyone else, a kind of total equality of believers before God. This idea that our moral and ethical actions are really what matter. That's what brings salvation or damnation, you know, not just uttering the right words or, you know, these various other belonging to the right tribe. This kind of rational, you know, moral ethical aspect of Islam is a huge advance on the earlier monotheisms. It throws away some of the crazy aspects of the earlier monotheisms, like the tribal god, Yahweh, who does so many crazy psychopathic things in the Old Testament. That's gone. God's justice is constantly emphasized in the Quran. The story of Job, which gives us a pretty, you know, cruel version of God that is really, you know, questioned by that story in the Bible, is resummed up in the Quran saying, well, the point of this story is that this guy had faith and was rewarded, which makes it's not as good a story in the Quran. For literature, it's better if you read the story in the Bible. But from the theological perspective or as a religion, as scripture, it's obviously so much more sensible in the Quran. And, you know, it gets rid of this crazy, you know, the world is fallen, humans are fallen, God had to torture his son to death to redeem the fallen world. I mean, that's crazy. It's just, you know, it's bizarre. And Islam chain, you know, drops that. I think it really has a case that a rational, sensible person who just compares these monotheisms would have to say, well, Islam is obviously a major improvement here. It's, you know, maybe it, you know, there's a lot that still has to be said, even after we read Quran and so on. There's, you know, everybody has their own spiritual journey. But the way things are portrayed in the media and Western culture, that Islam is so primitive and retrograde, it's actually the opposite. And maybe that's partly what scares the world, that actually this religion, oh my goodness, it actually makes sense. Are we going to fall back into monotheism just because one of these monotheisms actually pretty much makes sense? That's a scary prospect to people who are rebelling against monotheism. So people like these anti-religious Freemasons and other sort of fanatical fundamentalist atheists.
Yeah, well, I like the old religion that we had up in the north way back. It was one that was definitely in tune with nature. There were a multitude of gods or deities that represented different qualities, and there was a multitude. It was this idea that you talked about, it the oneness was not there, there was a multitude there, and I think that this homogenization and idea of that everything is one or coming out of the one is actually a problematic one. But that's just my belief, you know, that's just my theory.
I used to think that way too, so yeah. I totally understand.
All right. Well, this has been really interesting. Thank you for your time, Kevin. Really appreciate it. It's always fun and interesting hearing from a different perspective. And we appreciate you coming on, of course, and sharing your time with us. Is there anything else you'd like to, I guess, leave us with? Or, of course, we want you to give out your websites and everything again so people know where to go if they want to follow you on a more regular basis. Please go ahead, Kevin.
Well, my website is truthjihad.com. And I do write for veteranstoday.com and presstv.com. And anybody who's interested in sort of helping the United States of America change its path might want to consider helping us out with the Million American March Against Fear, which will be on September 11th, 2013. You can Google either Million American March or Million Muslim March, which will take you there. We're hoping to go to Washington, D.C. on September 11th, 2013 and try to cure the U.S. of the psychosis that it's fallen into since September 11th, 2001.
All right, there we go. We'll have the links up on redicecreations.com, so click through from there easily if you want to. Okay, thanks, Kevin. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Great conversation. Appreciate it.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Stay inquisitive and stay tuned to Red Ice Radio as we continue to explore the unknown, as we continue to bring you essential material and research that hopefully will make you think twice and question why things are the way they are. My thanks to Fredrik, Lana and Elizabeth at Red Ice, and a special thanks, as always, to you for your continued support for being a member. Be well, stay safe, and we'll be back with more before you know it.